Let's get into investor insights.
Yes, please.
What does this week look like?
All right. So last week I had alluded to speaking about default retirement options for employer groups. I do not know whether, and just coming from the conversation about women, right? Mm-hmm. And having to relook at how we give women advice in terms of their retirement planning. Should we leave it to trustees to make that decision? And for me, the reason why I'm asking this is I feel like it's such a difficult decision considering the fact that you're not always going to know the makeup of your staff to be able to considerably look at a default option for the entire employer group that makes sense for each and every single individual there.
Yes, but.
There's always a but. Go for it.
I mean, it depends. So by default, I mean, and I haven't worked in a corporate for a while, but my default options were, there were three, and it was basically high, moderate, and low risk. I think the default there was actually moderate, if our memory serves correct. The point is, if you are anything under 65 or 75 years old, you should just be in high risk. You should just be in high risk because you have time on your side. And I know folks are like, oh, I'm retiring at 65. But you're retiring at 65, but you're living to 95. So you've still got 30 years. So at some point you want to start de-risking it. But if you are working, you do not – I mean, maybe as you get a little bit closer, maybe 5 or 10 years out, you want to drop it into the moderate. You never want to be in the low risk. Unless, you know, and you basically, you want to be in high risk. You want that volatility. You want the horrible experiences of market crashes, because you get the flip side, which is these crazy rallies that markets typically go higher.
So the interesting thing, and I think this is probably where the question is coming from, Nicolette, as well, is this kind of information was never really out there for us, right? So if you haven't worked in financial services and you haven't got that knowledge, it's difficult to comprehend this. When someone says high risk, you think I'm going to lose all my money. And that's because there have been bad apples that have operated in this space that have taken people's money and done things they shouldn't have, or people that have over-leveraged or overexposed and that sort of thing. Simon's point around high risk is to say there's a certain level of volatility, or there's a certain level of movement in the market where the risk is justified because the reward offsets it.
Absolutely.
And that's something that we have to first of all comprehend and understand. But when you think about your portfolio, I think another part of it was when, if we set your portfolio to low risk, I as an asset manager with an asset management license don't need to do much. If my benchmark that I if my benchmark that I need to beat is 1.5%, and I annually do 2.5 to 3%, one, I've beat benchmark; two, I get to charge you the 2.5%; three, I don't have to do any of the work. So it's kind of an environment where it's not. And for me, as someone that's been stepping into asset management from an alternative asset point of view, it's been frustrating to say, guys, we should be, as asset managers, as an industry, we should be offering and generating more returns than what we're generating for clients. Yet we sit back and you look at the benchmarks and you look at the top 40 doing 6% or 5% for the year, and then an asset manager will do 6.5%, and you say, guys, just put the money in a fixed deposit. Then you're not actually the whole
doing
point
extra,
of, right? And this is where it comes back to what you're suggesting around the portfolios and everything. The reality is we could have a lot better in terms of performances for these portfolios and the performances in general, or the returns in general, and that would last a lot longer into retirement. There's a risk-averse approach from the asset management side of it. There's a risk-averse approach that is conditioned into the client to say, don't take risk. Risk is bad. Risk is not for you. It's only for you until you are 30 or until you have children. Now, as asset managers and as trustees, which comes back to your question, those trustees are trained. We'd like to think.
I was about to say.
Well, trained by doing some heavy lifting in that sentence.
Your job is to manage risk.
But isn't it partly also the language? To your point around high risk.
Absolutely.
So there was a thing which I stumbled across about 10 or 15 years ago that I loved, but it never took off. It was term date product. So you're in a fund that is for 35, and that's when you turn 65. In other words, your retirement date matches with the fund. So we don't call it high risk, low risk, offshore, local. We just know that you want this
fixed
money.
Fixed term contract. At that time, you are out.
And you want your money on this date. So between now and then, Don't stress it. Yes. We will glide you out. Now, there's always a risk they'll take you too low risk when you get near retirement. Yes. But that sort of thing, to remove away the language, which is scary. Because which person in their right mind
is going to go high risk?
Yeah. Well, you think of a young single mom joining a big corporate, you know, nice fancy job. High risk? No.
Absolutely.
I've got children. I've got responsibilities.
But that's the wiring, right? So that's the wiring that's been conditioned in the language that you're saying, is that we've been predisposed to say that is bad.
Yes.
That is a no-no.
Yes, yes.
And when you think about what high risk could potentially mean, it could mean that your portfolio, instead of going at a risk percentage of 10%, we're now risking at 20%, which is twice what it would have been. But your return profile, instead of aiming to return 30%, we're now aiming to return 60%. How much more of a difference does that make when we look at your retirement in the long term? And as I said, you don't have to be high risk your entire life. You can be high risk for 20 years of the life, but there must be a time in life. And it's easy to say be high risk in your 20s or in your 30s when you've got nothing to lose.
So here's my take, right? I retirement fund providers obviously do not like me much, because I always say you don't need a retirement fund, you need funds in retirement. Which ultimately is going to have a makeup of some
you
retirement
need the
fund.
Money.
So could we help then people then, and I guess this is what this segment is all about, is to try and offset the ordinary person, that if you are going to find yourself in a low risk default option in your retirement, then on the other side, follow what we're trying to teach you, right? In terms of then you're putting together your own individual investment portfolio. And I guess there is an opportunity for us to then teach about the risk and reward relationship.
I think we're seeing that more. I think we're seeing that more emerge in the generational or the age differences, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I look at my setup and in my personal journey in finance, and I look at the journey that my mother went through. And I use my mother as an example because she's a civil servant, which means her funds are sitting with the PIC, which means they're being invested by the Public Investment Corporation. Some of the decisions they've made, I would have never made. I don't agree with. We can't be putting 4.3 billion rand into companies and then being told you can't get that money out. You know what I mean? That's a material number. But I think we're also coming into the phase where, and I remember the example I used, I think it was a couple of episodes ago, where I said a friend of mine is starting a property portfolio, and he's understanding and he's leverage, and he's gearing one property into the other. I think we're going into that phase where you're starting to make more conscious decisions because you're doing your own research, because information is out there, and we can do our part. I mean, we can help with providing that information where we can, but I definitely think the landscape is changing, and you're also it's not just South Africa. You're seeing it in America as well, where and the whole world, in fact, where Gen Zs are saying, I'm not going to save for retirement. I'm going to live for experiences, and I'm going to live my life for the things I can control now. And if I'm going to invest in property, or if I'm going to invest in things, I'm going to invest in things I understand and things I believe in. And that poses quite an interesting challenge to the retirement funds. I mean, yes, they'll still have the corporate businesses they can go into and get corporate clients and that sort of thing. But more and more people are becoming aware.
And managing their own. You've got your retirement fund, which is going to be boring and Reg 28 and all of that, and have hundreds and thousands of stocks and bonds and stuff. And then you're going to open yourself a brokerage account. And assuming you're not, you know, there's ETFs and tax-free, as soon as you go and venture and buy an equity, you are now getting a pointy high-risk area, because you just, as an individual, you can't manage that level of risk. You can't have, I mean, in my equity portfolio, if I have 15 stocks, I think I've got too many. You know, it's highly concentrated. So maybe my risk comes from my self-managed portfolio. Now, again, back to the question and back to the debate from 2 weeks ago, men versus women. Women go for ETFs because they are risk averse for all, you know, bunches of reasons. So then they don't get the growth in their money, and then they live longer.
But they're taking the first step in self-managing. Right?
Yeah, sure.
Because that self-management part of it is so important, Si, as you say, because there's a part of it, and we spoke about this when we spoke about the trustee part of it. There's a part of it where you say, I don't want to think about some of the decisions because I've got other things on my plate. But then there's also a part where you say, do you know what? Maybe I can have a little fun. Maybe I can learn about this. Maybe I can grow here, here, and here. And you start a side hustle. You start a bakery. You start an in-home business. You go out and that is diversifying your portfolio.
Absolutely.
It doesn't have to be diversification across the asset classes that we know and love. Mm. Diversification can come in many forms.
Mm. Yeah, and that's your point. You don't want a retirement fund. You want funds at retirement.
Yeah,
absolutely. So the next one that I want to talk a little bit about, it came out quite a number of months ago, OpenAI partnering with Apple.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, first and foremost, it gives OpenAI access to, I do not know how many handsets and how many
about
laptops.
About a billion.
And that's quite enormous, right? Then I think last week or this week, they've come out to say they are launching their own search functionality, which is obviously going to now rival Google.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts on that? I just want to get a sense of where are we going? Do you think Google is still going to have a place in this market?
Absolutely.
Why? Why do you think that?
Think about Microsoft Linux.
Mm-hmm.
Think about Apple Samsung. Think about there's always going to be competition. There's always going to be a challenger for the top spot.
Hmm.
But look at how Google has completely dominated Yahoo, MSN, Bing, and everything else that has come before it.
Mm-hmm.
It is a behemoth of a business. They are on every device. The only thing that Google misstepped on.
Okay.
And this is my only criticism towards that business, was wanting to make it mandatory for all Android devices to be by default on Google. That was what sparked this whole thing, this whole row about wanting to find alternatives, right?
Yes,
there was a time where Google said, if it's an Android device, the only search engine or the first search engine must be Google.
Yeah.
You can't have an open sourced software or an open platform where people can make their own choices and then want to dictate what those choices should be.
Uh-huh.
I welcome, and you both of you know my feelings on Apple.
I'm so passionate about
No, but I welcome this.
No, Dave, Google's going to be in the next 20 years.
No, I welcome competition. I don't have anything, I don't hate Apple.
Yeah.
Apple is not a bad product. It is an efficient product. It is remarkably efficient. And in that efficiency, to be able to expand that is the trick, is the challenge. Mm. Look at Apple's lack of innovation in the iPhone since Steve Jobs has passed away.
Mm.
From where it started to now the fact that the last three or four iPhones have looked pretty much the same, right?
Yeah.
But if you can find a way, whether you're Tim Cook, whether whoever you are, to have your little ecosystem start to grow like this without jeopardizing the existing ecosystem, then you're doing something right.
So apparently it's actually 1.5 billion Apple devices. But that includes watches and TVs. But that means there's still 6.5 billion to go. I think Google has... I mean, it's a tough one. Have you been on Google search recently? It is a cluster nonsense of rubbish and ads and SEO.
Prioritizing revenues and other things.
Et cetera. It's just not a good experience. I mean, I use Anthropic, the Perplexity, for my search these days, which is Perplexity's an open AI competitor. Because I think Google's search in many ways is, and that is their crown jewel. It's what, 80% of their profits. But the search experience has gone so south. If you think back to the Google page of 20 years ago, which was nice and clean and simple, and now it's just this mess of chaos. And when I do click on a link, it's some server farm somewhere generating rubbish content.
But everybody's a threat to Google, because Google, as first mover, your thing everybody can learn from the mistakes you made.
Mm.
Everybody has the advantage of your hindsight as their foresight. So they can sit there and say, okay, cool, these guys went wrong here. Right, so that's always going to be a threat that you face. Mm. It's about whether or not you've got a player that's brave enough to take it on, similarly to how we discussed the trade war and China being brave enough to take on the US.
Mm.
Apple is brave enough to take on Google, and they will. Mm. And how that ends, we will have to wait and see.
So Google search, 90-odd% market share.
There we go.
So of course,
so you have to have a challenger. You can't sit there and not expect anyone to show up to challenge that.
Yeah.
Are you buying Alphabet or not?
Here's a fun fact. So YouTube, in terms of revenue, is the size of Netflix. I mean, Google has a little, Alphabet's got a little Netflix sitting in their in their hut that sort of no one even knows about. But they own search, they've got Android, they're in cloud along with AWS and Azure from Microsoft. And I would certainly not bet against them.
There we go.
So it's a buy.
It is a buy, but at the right price, I think.
I mean, a forward PE of about 21, which is about the lowest it's been in the last decade. I mean, I take your point, and certainly we're seeing tech selling. It might get cheaper. But I mean, I think at current valuations, I don't think Google is as expensive. I mean, if you compare it to Microsoft, if you compare it to NVIDIA, heck, even just Apple. I mean, it's not an eye-wateringly expensive stock, but I do think you'll get it cheaper, perhaps as the
as the tech sell-off kind of happens. We're in a bit of a sell-off.
All right, so let's stay offshore and go BlackRock.
The company that owns everything.
That owns literally everything.
No, they literally own absolutely everything. Now, Simon said you don't want to bet against Google.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to bet against BlackRock. They own banks. And by banks, I mean like the size of JP Morgan.
Yeah.
And BlackRock has its hands in everything. I'm going to pull up some of their investments and give you a sense of the magnitude of what we're dealing with.
The stock has momentum. It's been moving higher nicely since the bear market lows of 2022. It's also, as markets go up, these guys make more money because they charge a percentage and therefore bull markets, these guys. So if we're heading into some struggles, they might struggle a bit. But let's roll forward 5 or 10 years. Markets are not at the same levels. They're higher just by dint of who they are. They have more profit and more money in the bank.
It's a buy?
Yeah, and I'd like it. Here's what I didn't know, and maybe Anthropic is lying to me. They bought iShares from Barclays in 2009.
They own iShares, the brand?
Yes, you know the ETF issue? Yeah. iShares is BlackRock.
Yes.
Wow. They bought it from Barclays.
Oh, no, that makes sense, yeah.
They bought it, Barclays.
I didn't know that they bought it from Barclays.
I didn't know that either.
Wow.
Ooh, shame, poor Barclays. Yeah. Barclays was probably going bust, it was 09.
All right, let's come back to South Africa. Famous brands.
They've been struggling along for quite a bit.
They've been struggling.
They're at 54 Rand. I kind of like them at 50 Rand. I'm not against them at this price. I just think having spoken to some of the other CEOs, I'm probably going to lean more to someone like a Spur.
Yeah.
I like what Val's doing at Spur as the CEO. I love the fact that where they're sitting, one, the share price is cheaper than the famous brand share price. But two, most importantly, and this is so critical when we're dealing with companies in the retail space or in the restaurant space, Spur is debt free.
Totally.
That's all I've got to say.
Yeah, both give good dividends. Both are on price earnings of about 12 times. Zero debt at Spur. Famous Brands are still paying off their disaster at Gourmet Burgers in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
But I was running the numbers. Assuming we get 2 rate cuts this year, September and November, 0.25% each, your average sort of family with a 2 or 3 million rand bond and 2 cars and all of that, they got $1,000 a month in their pocket back by December.
So more groceries, more eating out.
Yeah. Buy Famous Brands? Yes.
Yes.
Would I prefer Spur? Sure. But to answer the question,
so we'll buy both.
Yes.
Yeah, All right. But Spur's not on the table today, so put it on the side. Woolworths is my last one.
I've been in Woolworths.
I have been too. I've
loved Woolworths at anything between 55 and 60 Rand, and it's kind of below 60 Rand at the moment.
Yeah.
Bounced off 54 Rand. And the reason for that is there's this massive war in the supermarket space. Mm-hmm. You're not going to challenge a ShopRite. Please leave Peter Engelbrecht and his team alone. Those guys are on mission take over the world. The share price clocked, they gave us 53-week updates now. The share price clocked 300 Rand for the first time in its history. It stayed above 300 Rand. And Pick and Pay is the other one, and Spar is the other one, and Spar's trying to recover from their SAP issues, and Pick and Pay's got its own life challenges. It is seeing a lot of flames, but Woolworths has stayed in their corner. Woolworths has been like, this is what we do. We do it well. This is where we're going to sit.
Mm-hmm.
They finally got that David Jones monkey off their back.
But it's the doing well part I'm not so sure about. So the update from Spur.
From ShopRite.
The update from ShopRite showed us quite clearly that their store growth, same like-for-like sales, was below inflation, which means they're losing volume, whereas ShopRite is above inflation.
Yeah.
The fashion, Woolies just can't get the fashion right again and again.
It's a difficult struggle.
It's a difficult struggle, unless you miss the price, in which case it's the easiest thing in the world. And, I mean, buy Woolies? No. Buy ShopRite.
So we've spoken about this before, right?
Yes.
ShopRite at 300 Rand looks expensive in the South African context.
Okay.
But ShopRite, when compared to its global counterparts, and so I'll pull up the PE numbers about it, we've looked specifically at ShopRite versus a Target or a Walmart or something where they compete, because they compete realistically at that scale with the value chain that they've got.
Uh-huh.
If you're measuring them against their global peers, mm-hmm. it's the cheapest stock you can buy.
And let's be clear, if you measure it against its global peers, it's also the most profitable. Yes. All supermarkets with more than 1,000 chains, they have a higher operating margin.
Mm-hmm.
The mean is about 2.5%. ShopRite rocks at 6.5%.
They
obliterate the world.
This week of picks is a week of you don't want to bet against these guys. Mm. ShopRite's another one.
Is that the theme?
ShopRite's another one.
And ShopRite on a forward PE is average priced, even at $300.
So, okay. All right. I think we'll leave it there. I'll throw forward to next week. I want to talk a little bit about the franchise model, if it's something worth investing in. I think we've seen some South African entrepreneurs start this thing in South Africa. Don't go the franchise model.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to work for some of them. Obviously, we don't have the intricate numbers there, but we've also seen it work for others. But we've also heard about exploitation within the franchise model.
And you've seen guys that have built franchises and scaled too quickly.
Yes.
And it's gone pear-shaped.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So
yes,
definitely worth looking into. I think there's a lot to unpack there.
Oh, and Happy Women's Month, guys.
Happy Women's Month.
Thanks, guys.
And on that note, we'll leave it at that. Remember to follow us on our pages. We are on all our socials. We're on YouTube. We're on Twitter. We're on X. We're on every social we can think of. The podcast is available everywhere. So you really can't say we haven't put it out there for you. Until next time, investing isn't hard.
Just right.
There we go.